story is a Jewish folk tale. Now, do you know what a folk tale is? A folk tale is a story that's been passed down for so long that nobody knows who wrote it, but they like it, so they keep repeating it. So it's called a folk tale. It's a Jewish folk tale. Anna was in charge of the washing. It was her job to do the washing. And they didn't have a washing machine. She had to put all the laundry in a basket, big basket, and take it to the village well and wash it by hand, then bring it back to her house. Now, she didn't have a garden, but they had a courtyard, so she put a rope up between two poles, and she neatly pegged all the clothes up to dry. Now, it was a windy day, like yesterday. So I want you guys and everyone to be the wind. When it's a little wind, go. When it's a big wind, okay? So she hung the clothes up on the line, and it was a little wind, just right to dry the clothes. So she felt very pleased with herself and went in to make the supper. Meanwhile, her next-door neighbor, Sarah, was making her supper, and she found she had no vegetables. Panic. So she grabbed her shopping basket. She had to go to the store. And rushed out the door, and what did she do? She went head first into the wet laundry. All the water from the clothes had trickled down her neck. She got her hair messed up. She was really mad. So what did she do? Oh, she was so mad! She pulled her scissors out of her basket. What did she do? She cut the rope. And the clothes went flying all over the place. And there was a big wind. So a big wind. And the clothes went everywhere, even out into the street. Yeah. Anyway, she went marching off to the store. And she said, that serves her right, putting up wet clothes outside my place. Meanwhile, Hannah came out to see how her clothes were doing. What did she see? Her beautiful laundry, all dirty on the street, all over the courtyard. And she was getting so mad. But suddenly, there was a big wind. And she looked up to see where the wind was coming from. And the wind seemed to be speaking to her, saying, don't lose your cool, Hannah. You could easily go and wash these clothes again. No big deal. She listened. The wind's talking to me. So she thought, well, it is no big deal. She picked up all the dirty clothes, went back, washed them all again, brought them back, hung them all up in the line. Went in to make supper. Oh, yeah. What is Sarah doing meanwhile? Sarah is feeling badly. She's getting guilty feelings. And she peeks out and she sees the clothes all up in the line again. She thinks she's going to get a knocking on the door any minute from Hannah, who's going to be mad. She's feeling badly. 1 hour passes. No Hannah. Another hour passes. No Hannah. So what's she going to do? It's getting dark, getting twilight. She says, I'm going to go and apologize. So she goes to Hannah's door, and she knocks on the door, and she expects to see a furious, angry Hannah. But Hannah opens the door with a smile. And she says, I know why you've come, Sarah, but don't worry. You'll never guess what happened to me today. The wind spoke to me, a big wind. And what did it tell me? It told me that people are more important than clothes. And you are a good friend, Sarah, and you will stay my friend. But I've never known the wind talk to me before. You, the wind talks to you? Well, I think we should all listen to the wind, especially when it blows away our anger. Wind listens to you. Wow, you should have been here yesterday. Make it stop. The wind listens to her. So any of you want to listen? Especially if you have a sailing boat, you might want to listen to you. Anyway, thank you for listening.
Good morning, everyone. At the end of nurses' training, many years ago, I volunteered to go to Gaza City to work with Palestinian refugees in a mission hospital. The hospital was under the auspices of the United Church of Canada, the Baptist Church. Today, it is run by the Anglican Church. At that time, there were about 400,000 refugees living in Gaza and surrounding refugee camps. I worked as a nurse and taught in their nursing school for 2 years. I remember clearly, as if it were yesterday, the call for Muslim prayers early in the morning as the sun was rising, the smell of pita bread cooking in open ovens in the center of town, the taste of sweet mint tea always offered when you visited someone's home. I especially remember being overwhelmed the first time I saw refugee camps with thousands of people living in terrible conditions with no water. They had been displaced in 1947 from Palestine. In the hospital, the healthcare team of which I was a part, we cared for many people from simple illnesses. We did major and minor surgeries, delivered many babies. We cared for people especially from having terrible burns because, you see, they had no stoves to cook on, and they only had a Bunsen burner to cook on. So there were many terribly burned patients we cared for. Also, we cared for quite a few who had a strange disease called bilharzia, which is a parasitic worm disease caused from contaminated water they had contacted from the Nile River. However, more than these memories, what I remember, the kindness of those refugees. No matter what you did for them, small or large, they'd always say, "Oh, thank you, thank you. Thank you, Habibti. Shukran iktir, 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 anabihibtak inti." And in time, I learned to say those words back to them. No, thank you, and I love you too. I was evacuated in 1967 by the Canadian troops in Gaza. I watched as the first bombs hit the hospital. With great sorrow and guilt, I left, as I was one of only 6 Westerners in the Gaza Strip. The years have passed. Much has changed, mainly for the worse for the Palestinians. They now have over 1.5 million people in the space, smaller space than when I was there. Hopelessness has become a way of life. Desperate measures are now being taken. My heart continues to weep when I hear of the plight of the Palestinians. Thankfully, the world is now waking up to this desperate situation. Today, I ask you to hear the cries and the pleas from these refugees who only want what most of us want: food to eat, a way to make a living, education for their children, and a safe place to live. My experience in Gaza with the Palestinian refugees so many years ago changed my life then. And now, 50 years later, it continues to change it. Thank you.
One of my favorite songs is Imagine by John Lennon. I have been an activist in some areas, particularly the world of those with mental handicaps, but not in global political and peace issues. I have always been totally overwhelmed by these areas that seem to be beyond my capacity for helping, but I stand in admiration of those who do get involved. 3 years ago, I traveled to New York City with my daughter. On a walk through Central Park on a beautiful May morning, we searched for strawberry fields, a 2.5-acre area shaped like a teardrop developed in the memory of John Lennon. I did not know what we would find, so was blown away when we came across a large round mosaic lying on the ground with the word Imagine in the center. I stood staring at it, surrounded by many others. But in a matter of minutes, I was standing totally on my own. I expect being alone at this memorial does not often happen. My daughter had gone walking off down the path with mutual friends. For me, it was a spiritual moment and a cherished memory. Going around and around in my head was Lennon's song. Imagine there's no countries. It isn't hard to do. Nothing to kill or die for, and no religion too. Imagine all the people living life in peace. As we sit in silence together, imagine.
Good morning. My name is Christine Johnston, and all of us presenting today are active in peace and justice issues. We plan to focus on the Unitarian Universalist principles, such as the inherent worth and dignity of every person, be they Muslim, Jew, Christian, or humanist. We also touch on peace, liberty, justice, compassion, and democracy. We Unitarians try to be in the forefront of human rights. And this year, I am proud that nearly every UU society across Canada has held a service and workshops on this topic. 50 years ago, I made an enjoyable visit to this area, but as a very naive tourist. Now I would join the well-known Jewish psychiatrist, Dr. Gabor Mate of Vancouver, who says, "The beautiful dream of Israel has become a nightmare." Many say it is a complex situation. The solution certainly is very complex, but the cause seems to me fairly simple. Europeans treated those of the Jewish faith very cruelly over the centuries, ending up with pogroms and the terrible Nazi Holocaust. In some places, they still face persecution, though this is mixed with anger at Israeli policy. In 1948, instead of giving them a safe haven in the West, whether in the USA or in Europe, the United Nations approved that they take part of an already occupied land, where the indigenous population was not powerful enough to resist. A Zionist colleague of mine told me the situation is surely no worse than the colonization of the Americas by the might of Britain and Europe. I agree. The apartheid policy of South Africa actually copied Canada, and Israel copied South Africa, resulting now in their own brutal brand of apartheid. Fear, even paranoia, is nurtured everywhere as a means of political control. I try to empathize with the Zionist policy today, but in vain. Even most of my Jewish friends tell me that while their heart is with Israel, they cannot support the Zionist occupation, the blockade of Gaza, and the disregard of all the UN resolutions. Did you know there are more United Nations resolutions against Israel than against any other country in the whole world? Some protest Israel is more democratic than its Arab neighbors. But of course, since Israel boasts it is a Western outpost or colony. Gabor Mate writes, "My heart tells me that never again is not a tribal slogan." He continues, "The murder of my grandparents in Auschwitz does not justify the ongoing dispossession of Palestinians. Israel's slogan, of the right to defend itself does not validate mass killing and the stealing of land and resources. Why action now? Recently, there is a massive growing awareness around the world that people of goodwill should intervene against the huge power imbalance, the illegal occupation and blockade. Literally, thousands protested this summer all over the world. In London, England alone, there were 150,000 people protesting in the streets. And many are following the boycott of Israeli products from the West Bank. They agree with Nelson Mandela, who said, "Our freedom is incomplete without the freedom of the Palestinians." Israel claims it wants security and peace. However, I doubt this will come without justice. Some try reconciliation and dialogue, as does a Jewish Israeli friend of mine in Jerusalem. Another famous Israeli speaking out is Miko Peled. Despite being a son of one of the founding families of Israel and having lost a niece to a suicide bomber, he still works hard for the liberation of Palestinians, and his book is called The General's Son. He would agree with Rabbi Michael Lerner and Dr. Gabor Mate that Zionism is contrary to Judaism and is destroying the moral fiber of Israel. Even our local rabbi, Carrie Brechner, said recently at a Muslim-sponsored gathering that key to Judaism is love of the other, those who are different. Another powerful book I read is I Shall Not Hate. It was written by a Gaza Palestinian, a doctor, Abu Elish. He traveled daily through humiliating checkpoints to work in Israel to help Israeli women with infertility. But three of his daughters and a niece were deliberately targeted, decapitated by an Israeli shell. As a Unitarian, I do not believe in any chosen people, nor in a God who is a real estate broker giving this land only to the Zionists. I believe in basic human rights and justice. I believe in the inherent worth and dignity of every human being. Thank you.
My name is Ed Daniel, and I want to explain how Palestine is in the course of disappearing. The first step had to do with the role of the United Nations. And even though only 7% of the land was owned by Jewish people in 1947, the UN decided to give the majority, 56%, to the Jewish state. So that's how the first step occurred in the UN plan. So that's what happened in the first step. Then Al-Nakba, the disaster happened. When the Palestinian people rejected the UN plan and the Zionist state accepted it, a war broke out, but it was an uneven war. And as a result of it, there were more than 750,000 Palestinians displaced from their land and homes, and they were not allowed to return. It was done after a massacre in Deir Yassin and various other brutalities and continued brutal assaults, which drove out 750,000 Palestinians. After the end of that war, Israel claimed 78% of the land, and Palestinians were left with only 22%. And that's what you have here. But then Israel made another move. In 1967, it undertook a peremptory war and expelled an additional 350,000 Palestinians from their homes and land. And it immediately began a systemic system of building internationally, under international law, illegal settlements in the West Bank and Gaza. So now, there are 650,000 illegal settlers in the West Bank and in East Jerusalem, which is also part of the land that was supposed to belong to the Palestinians. So there is where we have what we have after the 1967 war. And that's what we have now that the settlements have gone and taken more and more of the land. It's estimated that the land left for the Palestinians is less than 15%. So, and beyond that, Israel has carried out a campaign of taking over additional land by a variety of techniques, declaring land a closed military zone so that Palestinians can no longer have it, use it, grow crops. Forceful takeovers of Palestinian homes by Israeli settlers, particularly in East Jerusalem, and so on. In the West Bank, 60% of the land is in what's called Area C, and that's under Israel control, where it carries out a systematic process of removing Palestinians from their homes along in that land, which include the Jordan Valley. But the point is, even though their land is almost gone, the Palestinians are not gone. At this time, in the West Bank, there are 2.5 million Palestinians, and in Gaza, about 1.8 million, a total of about 4.3 million. That does not include the 1.8 million Palestinian citizens of Israel. Thus, there are over 6 million Palestinians in occupied Palestine, in addition to the 5 million refugees in Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, and in occupied Palestine. So there are just about, there are more Palestinians than there are the 6 million Jews in Israel. And that, of course, frightens the Zionists, and which considers it has a serious demographic problem. The problem really is that the Zionists believe that they are entitled to the whole of the land of Israel between the Mediterranean Sea and the Jordan Valley. And that's what they mean by when they say Eretz Israel. So, and originally these lands included actually more, part of Lebanon, the West Bank, the Amazon of Israel, the Negev and Eilat, and also, except for Negev, South Negev and Eilat, and small parts of Syria. So there's where we are. We have come from a situation in which Jewish people own 7% of the land to a situation in which now they own approximately 85 to 90%. The land is gone, but the Palestinians are not. Thank you.
My grandmother often said, "There but for the grace of God go I." When I was old enough and wise enough to see what was happening in the world, I could not sit idly by. I became an activist, and I hope you will too. Olive trees. Olive trees are the staff of life in Palestine. They take 3 to 12 years to bear fruit, depending on the cultivar. Some are recorded to be over 2,000 years old. They are considered to be part of a family's heritage and valued as an elder family member. When Jewish settlements were first established soon after Israel occupied the West Bank in 1967, they were mainly situated on uncultivated land, but more land was soon wanted. Since about half the cultivated land in the occupied territories is used for olive farming, olive trees became a major casualty of this expansion. About 80,000 Palestinian families who relied on income from olive farming have been directly affected. Olive trees were cut down or uprooted to make way for Jewish settlements only. And settlement roads, the separation barrier, Israeli declared nature preserves,
military bases, etc. 85% of the separation barrier is within the West Bank, not between the West Bank and the State of Israel. Farmlands. Palestinians must obtain hard-to-get special military permits to access their lands near the separation barrier. Israeli settlers have been reported numerous times as burning Palestinian crops and bulldozing farmlands and olive trees. The Israeli military fires on the farmers of Gaza who are in range of the separation fence, often using snipers and robot guns, and crops have been decimated in the Gaza shellings. All of this seems aimed specifically to get Palestinians to vacate their lands. To add to these problems, Israeli settlements and industry get priority use of water. Settlers get 4.4 times the water that Palestinians get. The Israeli army also regularly destroys Palestinian wells and cisterns. This is an example of the different sides of the separation barrier. The Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions has the best data about the demolition of Palestinian homes. 531 Palestinian villages and 11 urban neighborhoods inside the State of Israel were systematically demolished between 1948 and 1960. This was not done in the heat of battle, but well after residents fled or were driven out so that their lands could be turned over to the Jewish population. Some houses have been demolished repeated times as the owners try to rebuild. For instance, Canada Park was created on the land of four destroyed Palestinian villages, and dozens of ancient homes were destroyed to create a plaza for Jerusalem's Wailing Wall. This demolition has continued to this day throughout Israel proper and in the Israeli unrecognized Palestinian and Bedouin villages. Whereas in 1924, the Israeli government even announced the formation of a demolition administration in the Ministry of Interior to oversee the demolition of homes of Israeli Arab citizens. Whereas Arabs still comprise almost 20% of the population of Israel, they are confined by law and zoning policies to a mere 3.5% of the land. Palestinians are utterly frustrated by the impact of Israeli policies on their lives. They can't move freely around their territory. They can't farm their land freely. They can't plan their communities. They are evicted from their homes. Their homes are regularly demolished. If these travesties do not make you an activist for peace and justice, what will?
And my name is Adrian Fine. I'm a Jew by birth and by culture, and I am proud of its principles and history of compassion and social justice. Israel, before the Six-Day War in 1967, was not a hugely important part of the consciousness of diaspora Jews. Now, for a large proportion of world Jewry, both as individuals and as communities, Israel has become the major focal point of their Jewish identity, resulting in an astonishing level of moral, financial, and political support for the country, regardless of its policies. Bill Clinton once described the Israeli lobby as the most potent force in America. Criticism of Israeli policies as a Jew inevitably results in admonishment from fellow Jews. I'd like to tell you why I feel obliged to speak out. Prior to doing this, I'd like to disclose that I roundly condemn acts of violence by Arabs against Israeli citizens, as well as any overt anti-Semitism that exists in some Arab countries. The colonization of the West Bank is clearly and absolutely against international law. The willful destruction of and eviction from Arab homes is against the International Declaration of Human Rights. Restrictions on travel to and from one's homes is against the Human Rights Convention. An abundance of evidence exists that there are serious inequalities in the administration of justice in the occupied territories between Jews and Arabs. The deliberate targeting of civilian targets, as in the Gaza and Lebanon wars, is against the Geneva Convention, as is the use of phosphorus bombs, which were used in the last but one war in Gaza. There's been a recent upsurge in the open criticism of Israel, including various boycotts. Many Jewish groups have been formed openly critical of Israeli policies. These have been branded as extremist by mainstream Jewish organizations. A new response to the criticism of Israel's policies has recently arisen. Anyone who criticizes Israel is an anti-Semite. Last year, Secretary of State Kerry was branded by some of the Israeli media as an anti-Semite. Similarly, Jimmy Carter is widely accepted as a bastion of anti-Semitism for his criticism of Israel. This is an absurd obfuscation. Not only that, it denigrates the very significance of the crime of anti-Semitism and its ghastly history. Our own Canadian Parliament, just a couple of weeks ago, has fallen for this ruse. In fawning to the mainstream Jewish lobby and the evangelical Christian sentiments, it has declared that singling out Israel for selective condemnation is discriminatory and hateful, and not saying so is dishonest. Well, I am proud to plead guilty. It's worth noting that all the human rights abuses that I've alluded to and have been alluded to in the previous three speakers have been meticulously documented by numerous Israeli Jewish human rights organizations and in the Israeli Jewish media. I, as a Jew, and those Jews who openly criticize Israel cannot possibly be accused of anti-Semitism. Indeed, as a Jew, I feel a moral obligation to stand up for human rights in the occupied territories and to speak out. I find it extraordinary that for thousands of years, the Jews of the world have suffered the effects of discrimination, but were never in a strong enough position to do anything about it. But what do we do now that we are in a position of power and control for the first time in our history? We have placed millions in the same trough of discrimination. It is a moral tragedy of epic proportions.